Suzanne Simard has devoted her professional and her personal life to this idea that trees communicate with each other by emitting chemical signals. She discovered that trees and the other living things in a forest are linked by this system of underground channels where they connect and they relate. And she can trace this idea back to the summer when she was a kid. Her family would spend the season on her Uncle Jack's houseboat on Cottonwood Bay. This is in British Columbia. It's a rainforest. And one day, the family dog, a beagle named Jigs, got into trouble and really changed everything.
This particular year, I was about 6 years old, and my dad was making pancakes. And all of a sudden, we could hear Jigs howling up in the forest. And everybody looks at each other and they go, ah, Jigs is at it again. And from the howling, you could tell it was muffled. So we knew he had fallen in the outhouse. You know, we all got up in our pajamas, running up the gangplank to the shore. And Uncle Wilfred is already running up with his shovel and pickaxe. And Grandpa Henry is behind him. And we're all running up and open the outhouse door. And the flies are flying out. And we're all kind of laughing. And Jigs is down there just howling, baying like a beagle does. And my uncles just started digging. They got their pickaxes and their shovels, and they have to dig out the side of the outhouse because he's down there 6 feet and he's in the poop. And he's covered in toilet paper and he's just not very happy at all. And I'm just like fascinated by this whole scene. Like, they start digging out, taking out the forest floor and throwing the mushrooms off into the bush. Chanterelles and the boletes and the amanitas, and they're just flying through the air, and they get down into the roots. And of course, it's hard to get through the roots because these forests are so thick and entwined. You know, their roots are all over each other. Birch roots and cedar roots and all their different colors, and thick, right? Really thick. And then underneath the roots is this mineral soil. And I'm just fascinated because it looked just like the sand on the beach. And then right underneath that, there is this really deep red soil. I'm fascinated by these rich, rich colors of the soil. It took a long time, you know, a couple of hours before they finally got down far enough and just to the point where Uncle Wilfred could reach down and grab Jigs's paws. And then, like, with a lot of cursing, they just pull him out. And, you know, he's covered in poop. And he's got toilet paper all over him. And I said, oh, Jigs. And took him down to the water and, you know, jiggled himself off. And it took a little bit of washing. But, yeah, we eventually got him cleaned up.
Jigs had no idea that his little adventure had, as you put it, opened up this whole new world for you.
You know, I knew the forest above ground because I spent, you know, my life in it. But I had no idea that underneath all that, there was this incredibly colorful, complex, fascinating place that was full of life. You know, there were bugs everywhere. There was fungi everywhere. The roots were thick and colorful, too. I had no idea they were so colorful. So, yeah, it was like opening up a whole new world for me that was just as fascinating as the above ground world.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Suzanne Simard is joining us today. She's a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia. She writes about how trees pass their wisdom to their kin. They share information about what helps or harms and how to adapt and survive. As she puts it, it's what all parents do. The name of the book is Finding the Mother Tree. And in it, she tells about working a seasonal job for a logging company in Western Canada. This was when she was in her 20s. She had been given the job of checking out a section of forest that had been clear-cut. The idea was to see how the new seedlings that had been planted were doing. And it turns out, not very well. And she couldn't figure out why. As she was puzzling over this, she slipped on a steep slope and she fell. And she reached out on her way down and grabbed a sapling, a small tree. It came out of the ground into her hand.
I'm looking at the roots that I had sort of partially ripped out, and I'm going, holy cow, like this, these root systems are complex. They're, you know, they have roots that go off in, you know, different directions, and they're crooked, and they're, they end in these very fine root tips. So they basically are the cement that cements the tree to the soil. And then at the end of the root tips were these sort of ribbons of fungi that were colorful and yellows and oranges and purples and white. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, this is just completely different than the seedlings that we plant in these clear cuts, which are grown in these little, they're called styrofoam plug holes. And they basically fill them with some kind of rooting medium, put a seed in it, and the roots develop like a bullet almost, right? Mm. Straight down. And I'm looking at these roots with these fungi on it, and I'm thinking about these seedlings that we plant, and I go, we've missed something really important here. You know, you can spend your whole day just trying to survive, and then you have these moments where you discover something. Mm. And as you're, you know, trying to survive in the bush and trying not to encounter a grizzly bear, my mind is thinking and thinking about these roots and slowly making this realization that this is the problem we're having, is that we're not creating seedlings that are like the ones that are growing naturally. You know, I eventually figured out the reason that these roots are so complex and grow in all directions, and they have so many fine roots, is that they have to get enough anchor to the soil, and they also have to get enough nutrients and water to get them through those first few years of their life. And so they explore in ways that will do that. They find those little, you know, rich patches of nutrients. They find that soil pore with water. They mine for them. They find them. Whereas a seedling that's embalmed in a little plug, really, it takes them a long time to grow out of that plug. In that first year, or those first few years, they really have to, in order to get enough to feed their, you know, their need to transpire and photosynthesize to build enough leaves to actually make it on their own. And if they can't get their roots out in that first year or two, they become sick and they just die. And I'm thinking, we're missing this part.
Yeah. You said that all the new seedlings were struggling. Every single sad little planting, you said, was struggling. And then you say this. You mentioned that you couldn't tell if your blood is in the trees or if the trees are in your blood. And that is why you needed to find out why these seedlings were, as you put it, fading into corpses. Explain that, because the book is about, part of this is about how you were, as you say, born to the wild. You came from the wild, and that was one of the reasons why you were trying to figure this out. Why were these seedlings not making it?
I grew up in these forests, right? I knew the grandeur of it. I knew in my soul, in my blood, in my DNA, I knew that the forest was an interdependent place. It was a social place. It's like trees grew together with plants, and they were in a community. I knew that just from being there, from living there. So yes, the trees, the forest was in my blood because I grew up with them. So this, all that, these observations, the figuring out that what we were doing was off kilter, it wasn't hard for me to actually put it together, because I had that intuition already. I already knew what a healthy forest looked like because I grew up in a healthy forest.
Yeah, yeah.
And because I came, my ancestors, like I had many generations of people who logged forests and lived in forests, that this was handed down through many generations to me. It just was around the coffee table, around the dinner table, around, you know, my grandpa and my uncle smoking and talking about logging. And, you know, it was just part of what we were. And so I had this kind of gift, right? I didn't realize it was a gift then, but I do now that I, because I was born into it, I had this sense. I just knew in my bones and my blood that this is how forests were meant to grow. And so then, you know, I started on this journey of, you know, eventually as looking at how we were going awry, like we were making mistakes in forestry, that we're not emulating how a forest grew. We were creating this situation that set them up for failure. And so then I knew that I needed to put myself into those trees, right? I need to become those trees, the sort of a champion for making, helping it become better, for helping us be better, you know, stewards of the forest, to be better caretakers of these forests.
So you write a lot about how for generations your family made a living cutting down forests. It's part of your legacy. But they were horse loggers, your family. And you grew up watching a different way of harvesting forests. Now, give us a sense of what's different. What's different from the way your grandpa and your uncles were doing it, from what you were seeing in the when you started to work for a logging company?
Yeah. So, you know, my grandfather, my uncle Wilfred, they made all their tools by hand. They made their boats by hand. They built the flumes by hand. Wow. They basically made their own nails and hammers. And, you know, the horses were huge. They built, you know, their own wharves to carry these horses across the lake. My grandfather even built a water wheel to sort of provide a bit of electricity for the logger's houseboat. So everything was slow and everything was laborious, but it was exciting, right? And it was death defying. And, but, you know, so when my grandpa would go up to log with his sons for the day, they would go to a patch and he would make a map. And the map would be where all the trees were. Where was that white pine? And where was that cedar tree and that hemlock? And we're going to take this one white pine today. And that's going to be the job for today. And he would be so careful. They would fall it in a certain way not to damage the other trees. He would fall it, of course, so that the horses could haul the tree to the flume. It was all done very, very carefully and slowly. It was a craft. And then when I started working for the forest industry, I went to forestry school. Of course, didn't even know that forestry school existed, but I happened to stumble upon it and got in. And I got a job in the forest industry because that's what you did as a student. We all
did. Well, it's not what you did if you were a woman, but that worked for you, I guess.
Well, you know, I was lucky because, you know, there were only like each class only had a handful of girls in them. And the companies were very reluctant to hire girls, but they started doing it. And I got a job with this company in Lillooette in the mountains. And that was when they were starting clear cut logging. And, you know, the logging in British Columbia had been ramping up over the decades from, you know, this small gypo logging that my grandfather did, these family operations, to actually parceling out big licenses to big companies. And back then there were way more companies than there are now. Today they've merged into just like a half dozen companies that basically log most of British Columbia. But so it's gotten even more mechanized. But back then it was like they've gone from, you know, basically hand sawing and then chainsawing. I remember the first chainsaws, which were built like a, you know, a two-handled Swede saw. And I remember, you know, my grandpa fiddling with the first chainsaws. But when I started, it was like, okay, it was all chainsaws. And they were starting with feller bunchers back then. They had high lead logging and it was clear cutting. That was completely different than what I saw Grandpa Henry doing. And then planting these forests to one species, not the myriad of species that lived in these rich, rich old forests. And they would plant the species that they made a lot of money from. So they'd pick Douglas fir, for example, and that was all they planted. Or they'd pick spruce, and that's all they planted. And so, yeah, it was a complete contrast. It would, you know, one way to think of it maybe be, you know, it's like going to a mom and pop Italian restaurant where they, you know, they have their specialty versus going to McDonald's, right?
Yeah. You tell the story when you were working that seasonal job for that company that there was this time when you went out with a man named Ray, young man like you, and the idea you had gone out with Ray to mark a boundary for a clear cutting. Ray shows you this aerial photograph where the timber is going to be cut, and talk a little bit about what you saw in that photograph, because one of the things you ask him is, I mean, you saw that they were going to cut everything, and you ask him. It sounds like a kind of naive question in some ways, but you're like, couldn't we leave some of the oldest ones here?
You know, being the only girl that worked in the company at that time, of course, you're always the assistant. And Ray wasn't much older than me, but he had more experience and he'd been working on the coast. He was, you know, he was a great technician and he really cared about his job. But, you know, they didn't know how to deal with girls at all. So so they kind of tolerated us or me. And this particular day, we were going up a creek called Boulder Creek, and they had punched punched a road in up this steep mountain, and they were punching it back into this pristine valley. And so we were following behind, laying out cut blocks along this new road. The forest was, you know, it was this really steep, narrow valley. You know, trees were basically clinging to the sides of the mountain, but they were huge trees. And the way that, you know, the most expedient way to harvest those trees was just to go along the road and make a square cut block. And so, you know, even though the forest itself would finger up to the high elevation forest, it was not even remotely square. Mm-hmm. It was forests that were punctuated by avalanche tracks on each side. And so they had a pattern to them. And these big old trees grew in these really, you know, nestled in these rich places where soil gathered and water trickled down through the rocks. And they had lived there for hundreds of years. I thought, you know, we're making these square clear cuts when we could make it a more natural look, and we could leave some of these old trees to provide seed. I was doing my job, you know, I was, as the technician, I was the chain man and he was the compass, or the compass man and he was the chain man. The compass man goes ahead and runs the line forward, which is what I was doing. And I was making this straight line and seeing these huge trees, you know, just inside or just outside. And Ray wanted to take them all. And I'm like, Ray, we could leave these because they exceed into the site and we would have a more natural forest coming back. You know, he was a company guy. Those company guys were devoted to the company. They loved their company. They loved their work. And he did too. And yeah. And he wanted to be a great technician, and he would be rewarded if he took more trees than not. And so, yeah, I argued with him, but I didn't win because he was set on fulfilling the need of the company.
Well, he saw some of these really ancient large firs just outside of the boundary of the clear cut.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, the company's going to love this. They're look how big and beautiful they are. But one of the ways you describe your reaction to that particular moment was that you said you felt like you wanted to scream at the top of your lungs.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a funny thing when you're out there doing that work, you know, you start to think like, you know, that you start, I don't know, it's like, I think I say in the book, like, it's like bagging a peak. If you're a climber, you see these peaks, and I do this when I'm, you know, driving along valley bottoms, and I think, I want to climb that peak. I'm going to get that one too. That's how the thinking goes, right? You think, oh, we'll get that big one. And I'm thinking, we could leave that one, right? But it was like gerrymandering, right? It was like gerrymandering around these big trees to get that tree to include it, because he was bagging the peaks, and I'm going, I don't think we should bag that peak, right? We need to leave that. But I did it because I was employed by the company too. And I really didn't have much of a voice. Like, he was in charge and he was doing what a company guy does, you know, working for the man. You know, I didn't really have a voice, but yeah, I was incredibly conflicted and I wanted to scream. Like, I was just like, ah, can't I do something about this? But I couldn't, you know. And maybe if I was braver, maybe if I was older, maybe if I had a bit of power, I could have. But at that moment when I was 21, I was just, you know, kind of grateful to have a job. And I loved being there and I loved the danger. I loved danger, right? Because I grew up in it, around it, and I did it, right? I did that thing. I ran the line around that tree to include it in the cut block. And there you have it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did that moment or moments like that contribute to you deciding, I can't do this for a living. I need to go back to school and do something else and figure something else out?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Like, I was so determined. I really wanted to work in the forest. I didn't really know the pathways for girls. There were no role models. You didn't see girls actually moving up in anywhere. Like, we were just all technicians or just glad that we were out there. Well, what I wanted to do is just be the civil culturalist for the company, which was the person who goes behind and reforests these cut blocks. And so I was focusing on that. I was thinking, if I can just, and I was learning so much, right? And I was getting better at understanding the ecosystems and being able to prescribe good planting plans. And I was trying to work towards getting that coveted job. And then swoop, it was given to a guy. I realize now there was no way they were ever going to give me that job. And so then I just thought, you know what? I gotta move on. I'm not going to make it here. Like, even though I loved it and I was getting so good at it, but there was no way I was ever going to move up. And so I started working for the government, there were more opportunities for women in there. There, you know, even though, you know, there were still not very many, but there was more opportunity to keep your job and actually go somewhere.
Suzanne Simard, she's a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia. We're talking about her book, Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
With KUER's mobile app, you can take all of our programming with you on the go. Hear the latest from KUER News and NPR, catch up on podcasts like Radio West and State Street, or tune into our continuous streams of the BBC World Service and classical KUER. Make KUER your companion wherever you are with the KUER mobile app. Available for free on Android and Apple devices. Start listening today by downloading it wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Suzanne Simard is with us explaining how a forest society works. It's built around trees, of course. Simard describes them as mother trees. And she says they're the hubs at the center of this network of communication and sentience. In her book called Finding the Mother Tree, she makes this case that trees communicate. They don't just share nutrients. They pass along information. The book is about her research and the work of others. It's also a memoir, her first insights about underground networks as a kid to her work with a logging company to doing her own experiments to test what she was seeing in the forest.
I eventually got a job with the government as a researcher after years and years of sort of doing piecemeal work and under the guidance of my great mentor, Alan Vise. We worked so well together and I learned how to do a little bit of science. And you know, in that process of, you know, learning about experiments and looking at plantations, I noticed, and he as well, we together observed that a lot of these plantations were not healthy. The seedlings that were being planted were dying, right? They were dying of root diseases. And especially when the native deciduous trees, so there's a succession in these forests, when there's a fire or a harvest or, you know, any disturbance, what happens is that you get all these different species come in together, but the fast-growing broadleaf trees, the aspens and birches and cottonwoods, they grow really fast and they dominate the plantations early on. And the conifers gradually grow up underneath and then take over as the deciduous trees reach their lifespan, which is usually about 50 or 60 or 70 years. But the foresters were saying, oh, we've got to get rid of these deciduous trees because they're killing the conifers. Whereas, you know, I was seeing this just as a pattern of succession, right? That this is naturally how this happens. These deciduous trees actually provide nutrients to the forest. They keep the forest moist. They're an essential part of the ecosystem. But the foresters were ripping them out because they viewed them as competitors. And that exacerbated this proliferation of these pathogens that were killing the conifers that they were actually wanted to grow. And so I wanted to figure out why were these pathogens becoming so infectious and infesting these plantations. And so I started, you know, looking below ground, and that's when I put two and two together that this is a complex world and we've basically thrown it off kilter. It's out of balance. And these pathogens, you know, when the deciduous trees were there, they were kept at bay. They were kept in balance. These pathogens were endemic in these forests, but they normally would only kill the odd tree that was weak and dying anyway. But what we had created was, you know, this opportunity for them to really proliferate and even kill young, healthy trees. And so then I just started looking at the other fungi and bacteria in the soil that were off, what was off balance here, and discovered, you know, about these mycorrhizas that I'd learned about before, and learned about studies that had shown that these mycorrhizas, these fungi that are helper fungi, not parasites like the pathogens, you know, some people had discovered that these could actually link trees together. So David Reed in the UK had done this incredible study. He had grown these seedlings in little garden boxes that had clear plastic on the sides. you know, and he inoculated them with one fungus, and it basically linked these two pine seedlings together. And then he took radioactive carbon dioxide and he got one plant to photosynthesize up that CO2, that C14 CO2. And he was able to use photographic emulsive paper to actually take a film. It was like taking a picture of it, but it was radioactivity that marked up that film. You know, and so then you could see that this carbon was moving from one seedling to another through this incredible network. And I was fascinated by this, of course, and thinking maybe this is the problem. If this network exists, we've disrupted it and allowed these pathogens to take over and become the dominant fungal community in the forest versus these helper fungi. And so that got me started. I went back and did my PhD on this. And I wanted to study how the pathogens interacted with the mycorrhizas, right? We were, you know, disrupting this mycorrhizal network. And I quickly learned that the foresters didn't know that much about these pathogens. They were so focused on like nursery pathogens. They didn't really know how to study these, especially as they interacted with these fine root mycorrhizal fungi. And so I remember my advisor, Dave Perry, saying to me, you know, you could spend like 5 years developing the methods alone to do this study, or you could just look at these fungal networks and probably find out, you know, just as much amazing stuff. And so that's what I did. I just focused on those networks, and I'm glad I did, because I uncovered, you know, brand new things that nobody knew, that these networks existed throughout the forest, that they linked together many species, birch and fir. And now I know like many, many species together. Yeah. Those forests have got 10 or 12 species growing together. They're all linked up together. And that carbon moves back and forth between these trees through these networks, following what we call source sink gradients, where a tree might be rich in carbon and nitrogen, like a birch tree, and it will shovel carbon and nitrogen to an understory Douglas fir. And the more that birch shades the Douglas fir, the more carbon it sends to it below ground. And I realize now, you know, it's to keep that community whole and rich.
I want to highlight that moment, because that seems really important. Because there's this idea that you were finding in the timber industry that trees competed.
Yeah.
And so what you had to do was kind of separate them, create space, as opposed to letting them connect together. And so the thinking that you're discovering in doing these experiments and this research is that, for example, the birch and the fir, they're sharing, as you say, carbon below ground. And yeah. That there's this balance going on, this kind of reciprocating process going on, if I understand this right, that mm-hmm. that I mean, one of the things the forest industry worried about was that these trees were competing for light, for, you know, for sunlight. Mm-hmm. But this process was going on where the birch, if it's shading a fir tree, it reciprocates by sending more carbon over. In other words, there's a relationship going on. It's helping nurture it, not stealing sunlight from it.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, as the birch was shading the fir more and more and more. So I had this experiment where I shaded the Douglas fir to different degrees. And what I discovered is that the more the fir was shaded by birch, the more carbon that birch sent over to fir. And so, yeah, it was definitely, you know, occluding light. So light comes down on the canopy. The birch is overtopping the fir, which is nestled under the birch crown. And so the light doesn't filter all the way down to the fir. So the photosynthetic rate of the fir goes down. And when you're in the forest and if you have a gas analyzer, which if you're lucky, you can use this, you can go around to these trees in different dapples of light, you know, in shade and open spots. And you quickly find out using these little machines how sensitive these trees are to light. If the sun goes behind a cloud, it instantly the photosynthetic rate drops. Mm. It's amazing how sensitive these trees are, how perceptive they are of their environment. And so, yeah, so the birch trees, the more they shaded the fir, the more they sent over to the fir, or the stronger the sink strength of that fir was, because its photosynthetic rate was going down, down, down. Yeah, and so they were totally attuned to each other. And it was a back and forth thing. It wasn't just a one-way transmission from birch to fir. It was a back and forth. So they were sensitive to each other.
It's like they're talking to each other in some way.
Yeah, they were communicating.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're communicating.
What's the evolutionary advantage in that for a tree? Why would a fir care about when it's shading another tree that's not its, you know, not of its species, why would it care about helping it? What's the evolutionary advantage there?
Well, you know, in evolution theory, we focus so much on species, right?
Yeah.
On survival of the fittest and individuals within species and the evolution of a species. And in that drive to understand that, people didn't really study communities until about 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. Well, I should say that, you know, Aldo Leopold and Whitaker and, you know, some of those early ecologists, of course, thought about communities, but evolutionary theory was very focused on individual species. Very few species, they don't grow alone, right?
Yeah.
Now we know that they're actually, you know, co-evolved with other species. So even, you know, people are, we're consortiums of species, right? Our guts are full of, you know, thousands of species of bacteria. Trees are also, they live together with many other species of plants and trees. That living together creates this vital soil condition where you've got all these other species growing in the plants themselves and on them and collaborating with them. And so the idea that a species grows alone is really, it's kind of an artifact of our scientific inquiry into evolution, at least in my mind.
Huh.
And, you know, even, but it doesn't mean that Darwin theory of speciation doesn't fit. It does still fit,
sure.
You know, it's just that it's not governed solely by competition and it's not solely one species evolving on its own, you know, pulling itself up by its bootstraps. It's evolving within a community of other species. And a healthy forest, a healthy community is diverse. And now we know that diversity, and many people have studied this, that diversity is correlated with productivity. And productivity, of course, is a key indicator of health of the systems. You know, how much photosynthesis goes on, how much biomass is produced. Those are key indicators of health and fitness. And, you know, in these complex systems in forests, having a myriad of species fills the niches in the forest. They're able to access resources in all these different spaces. Like think of the soil as the many layers and many pores and many different compounds, you know, where nutrients are compounded with organic material. And all the different species will access those in different ways with their partners, their fungal partners.
Yeah.
And so they work together to actually exploit, if you want to use that word, to fully utilize, to reach carrying capacity in that forest. And no one species is going to do that alone. And you could think of it not even just in terms of uptake of nutrients, but how they protect each other against and themselves against infestations of pathogens and insects that infest. They have these protective mechanisms that they work together to increase the fitness of individuals.
Yeah, well, this was a real insight for me from the takeaway from the book. You say it's not just resources that they're sharing. They're sharing information. So yes, they're communicating through carbon, but also nitrogen and water and hormones. I mean, there's information going on. There's a communication going on.
Yeah. I mean, I started working with resources early in my career because I was trained that trees and plants only compete with each other, like everybody else, right?
Yeah.
And so I focused on the big resources that we thought were what they were competing for, which were light or carbon, photosynthate, water, and nutrients. You know, it wasn't me that first started looking at information transmission. It was actually people that were studying how trees transmit information back and forth through the air. And so, you know, how an injured tree will transmit volatile organic compounds into the air that neighbors will pick up and then increase their own defense. And so I thought, well, I wonder if this is happening in the mycorrhizal networks as well. And so I started working with actually a scientist from China, Yan Song, who had done some work with tomato plants and mycorrhizal networks along these lines. And together we looked at this in the forest and found that, yeah, holy cow, that this information about, you know, the health of trees, you know, whether they're, you know, sick or stressed or, you know, vital or rich or whatever, that they actually transmit this information. And we particularly were looking at injury to trees. We were injuring trees using infesting them with worms and pathogens and even pulling their needles off, and found out that they transmitted defense signals through the networks where their neighbors, even of different species, would pick up these defense signals, take it as a warning, almost like they were, you know, eavesdropping on their neighbor, and then taking those warnings, upregulating their own RNA to produce defense enzymes that then they protected themselves against that injury that was that herbivore that was in the forest.
Are they asking for help? Is it Is it oversimplifying it to say they're basically asking for help? Like, I'm stressed out. Can you send some carbon this way? Or is it, or am I overthinking that there?
You know, what we found was that the stress tree, the one that was dying,
yeah,
was sending carbon as well as these defense signals out into the network.
Yeah.
You know, the network is a direct pathway to other plants.
Right.
And these other plants were picking up the messages. It wasn't the neighbor that was sending carbon back to the stress plant. It was the stress plant basically dispersing its energy, its last energy, to its neighbors.
Hmm.
And this also had implications for, you know, I started thinking about dying plants as well.
Yeah.
What is the role of this, right? Because what we usually think of is a plant dies and it just decomposes and it's energy is dispersed into the ethos, or it's just decayed through the series of decay organisms, the fungi and the bacteria. But what this showed was that it was actually, this energy was being directly transmitted into living trees. It was not dispersing into this broad general atmosphere or this broad general soil pool. It was actually directed into other trees that were living. And to me, this was a real revelatory moment for me that, you know, it was almost like purposeful, although I'm not sure that it was, but it certainly looked that way.
Well, you say you imagined the flow of energy from the mother tree, a dying mother tree, as powerful as the ocean tide.
Well, you know, I wrote that because, you know, I'm a mother myself.
Yeah.
And when you have children, you know, your life is like an ocean tide. Even giving birth, it's like, you know, it's like the waves of birth. And then your whole life is now focused on your children and the survival and the health and wealth and well-being of your children. And so I understood, right, as a mother, that that's what these trees were doing, right? They were directing, just like I was doing with my own daughters, they were directing their energy into their offspring. That's the ocean tide that I was talking about.
Yeah. You wonder also if, for example, a Douglas fir could recognize its own kin, like a mama grizzly and her cub. And talk a little bit about that, how you set about on this experiment to look into that question.
You know, science can be so fun. Like it, and it was like we'd done all these experiments where we had, you know, we figured out these old trees were so important. And like, they're important because they're the hubs of this network in the forest. They have huge root systems and huge crowns that feed these root systems and a ton of energy going out into their networks that link to all these other trees.
Mm.
And so we did all these experiments with these old trees, wondering, you know, were they actually important in the regeneration of the forest? And we would grow seedlings in these mesh bags where they could connect with the old trees or not.
Mm.
And we found that their survival was way higher when they could connect with the old trees. And so then I was thinking, well, these old trees are, you know, important in regeneration. And so then the next obvious question, I think, to anybody would be, are they favoring their own kin?
Right.
And so I learned about, you know, this researcher in Ontario, McMaster University, Dr. Susan Dudley, who was pioneering work in these other sort of herbaceous plants. She was working with these sea rockets that are like, you know, sort of plants that grow on the shores of lakes, and they're clonal plants. And she found out that they could recognize whether they were related, and they did this recognition mechanism happen through the roots. And I was thinking, well, you know, if it happens in those plants, could it happen in trees? And so I contacted her, and we worked with a graduate student, Amanda Asay, to ask this question: could Douglas fir recognize its own kin? And we found out that they could. And
wow.
You know, and of course, it's completely changed how I think about forests myself now.
Yeah.
That, you know, that really, it really is about, you know, these old trees nurturing the next generations, and really, you know, putting so much energy into their offspring, just like we do as human beings, just as bears do with their cubs and all the species in the world, really.
Well, and you say, you know, let's leave some of these mother trees in place. And also hold off on salvage logging, you say, because these older trees are contributing to the next generations, and it takes a long time for them to die. So they're passing on this, I don't know, I'll put it this way, wisdom, or certainly energy in an important way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think about now forestry, the practice of forestry truncates the beginning of the life of the forest and the end of the life of the forest. Hmm. We try to skip those phases, but those phases of birth and death are an essential part of the forest cycle. And if we remove them, which we try to do, we actually reduce the health of the forest because you miss those essential processes at the beginning. So we talked a lot in, you know, earlier on about how early in life, birches and alders and, you know, young native plants are essential in succession. Well, in the end of the cycle of a tree or a forest, the dying cycle, when a tree is starting to, you know, decline, well, that's a long, long process too. And there's so much essential stuff that's happening. And when we see trees dying, you know, as capitalistic society, you know, the first thought is, how can we make money from this? How can we capitalize on this death? And so the, you know, what we see in our landscapes where we have the mountain pine beetle or we have wildfires going through and there are trees left alive, the automatic reaction, oh, let's make some money from that. Let's go cut them down. But we're actually cutting off that very essential dying process where these old trees are passing on the wisdom, passing the carbon to the next generation, and actually affecting their genetics, right? It affects the genes. It affects the defense production of those seedlings. It reduces the ability of those seedlings to be healthy and to be agents of their own success in the future. We're shooting ourselves in the foot by doing this, by not letting these trees die out their natural life and then just letting them fall to the forest floor. And at that point too, life goes on because, you know, they serve as nurse logs. They serve as habitat for species that are important in the cycles of the forest. The mushrooms, the salamanders, the squirrels, the woodpeckers, they need habitat. And they're all part of this beautiful cycle that makes a forest work. I really, it makes me feel ill when I see this rampant salvage logging. It's thoughtless, really. You know, it's so focused on money making, or maybe, you know, falling trees to, you know, so that they might not fall on human beings. But you don't have to take out that many trees. You can leave a lot of dead trees and still have a very safe forest that's going to be able to give back to the next generations.
Suzanne Simard. Her book is called Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Weekends on KUER are filled with the same high-quality news and engaging conversations you hear every weekday. Keep up on the latest news with Weekend Edition and All Things Considered. Indulge your curiosity with Radiolab and Hidden Brain. Or dive into the rich storytelling of Snap Judgment and This American Life. The best in NPR news and entertainment awaits you this weekend on KUER. See what's in store at KUER.org/schedule.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Suzanne Simard is with us this hour, taking us through the remarkable network that runs underneath the forest floor. It connects all the trees into what she describes as a constellation of hubs and fungal links. Her book is called Finding the Mother Tree, and in it, she explains how forests are profoundly social and how trees communicate. They pass a kind of chemical wisdom to their kin about how to adapt and survive. The book is also a memoir. And for Simard, this has always been personal.
Science comes from us. Like, we are science. People are science. And I wanted to bring that human thing into my own scientific inquiry, that the questions I asked came from who I was, where I grew up, where I came from, what I cared about. And that the questions I asked was really came from a deep, deep caring and concern for the forest, for all of us, you know, for the health of all of us. And my scientific inquiry was informed by everything about me. You know, I wasn't just the objective clinical observer that was, you know, going, you know, doing the next thing because the scientific literature told me to do that next. It came from me, from my observations. And I did get breast cancer, right? I got breast cancer in my early 50s and it was serious. And I had to go through chemotherapy and radiation to save my life. And my kids were young teens at that time. And I came to this realization as I was doing these experiments, you know, and seeing how these trees were, you know, transmitting, these old trees transmitting carbon to neighboring plants, like that were different species. And I thought, I've got to know whether or not these trees are actually transmitting more carbon, more energy to their own offspring. Mm. And so I got, you know, my next grad student was, that's the question I have to ask, because I was struggling with that very question. You know, what do I do if this is my, these are my last few years or days or months, what do I do with my kids, right? Like my kids, I needed to make sure they were going to be okay, even if I wasn't there. And so I asked that question of the trees. I said, you know, I asked, do the dying trees, how do they protect their offspring even as they're dying? We basically took everything we knew about mycorrhizal networks and everything we knew about kin recognition and everything we knew about transmission of defense signals from tree to tree. And we created this experiment to test all these things together, all of these brand new discoveries, to do this daring experiment to see if they all work together for these old trees to actually care for their next generations, even after they're gone. And we found out that they all work together. And that was such a huge revelation, right? And it was so important for me to know that yes, my job is here, even if I am going to die, that I need to put everything into my children to make sure they're okay. Yeah, so it all worked together. Yeah. I wouldn't have asked that question if I hadn't been sick in the first place.
Well, the chemical that was helping in your recovery, I mean, it's a similar compound to what a tree produces to defend itself against disease.
You know, so I was going through chemotherapy. There were, you know, two sets of drugs that I was using. It was called a dose-dense regime. And they figured I was strong enough to handle this regime, which was very intense. And so the first set of doses were, you know, these older drugs that they called the Red Devil. And it made me so sick. And I thought, I can't do any more of this. And my doctor, Dr. Malpass, said, okay, we're going to switch to this, to Taxol. And Taxol is from the yew tree, which grows all around where I live. Taxol was discovered really by the Aboriginal people, or the yew tree was known as a medicinal plant. And then the USDA screened a whole bunch of plants and found out that Taxol is produced in great abundance by yew trees and that it is a cancer inhibiting agent. And it's really funny because at that time, you know, in those forests, when that was discovered in the 70s and 80s, that the forests were being stripped of yew trees because people were after the cambium, because that's where the tissues were producing the Taxol. It was the cambium. And then they developed this tissue culture where they were able to produce it in labs, and suddenly the yew trees were no longer being destroyed. And that was, wow, you know, which I was so thankful for. But it turns out that there are endophytes, there are fungi that live inside the cells of yew trees that also produce Taxol. And that Taxol is actually a defense enzyme that the tree and that fungus use to defend themselves against disease. And it works in human beings. When I went on Taxol, you know, I was getting better. And I thought to myself, I need to find out whether or not the production of Taxol by these plants is influenced by the health of the forest, and whether or not the neighbors around these yew trees influences the production of Taxol and the quality of that medicine. And so I have a graduate student right now, Eva Snyder, who is doing that work.
You say early on in the introduction to the book that it isn't a book about how we can save the trees, but how the trees might save us. Finally, say something about that, if you would. What are the lessons that we get from these networks that we could learn? Because you say in the book, the trees are like civil society. So what can we as humans learn from these networks about interdependence?
You know, I mean, you know, through our conversation, we've talked about our evolution of thinking too, right? About our thinking of how communities work, communities and forests. You know, what we've discovered about forests is that they're not just a bunch of trees competing, that they collaborate at the same time. They have sophisticated relationships that brings up the health and vitality of the whole community, that they're interdependent, that they are about their relationships with each other, right? It's not about themselves. It's about how they relate with their neighbors and their community. And I think that's a strong lesson for us, right? We're built the same way. We have social societies. We are interdependent and look after each other. And the more we do that, the healthier the whole community is. You know, all the players in the community, whether it's the grandmother who is, I don't know, looking after the grandchildren and baking pies, or the single mom that's, you know, trying to make a living, or the dad that is working, you know, really hard. We all work together. We support each other. And that's what brings up the whole society. You know, that's what makes us all whole. And trees and forests do the same thing. We've evolved that way because it works, right? It makes us resilient. You know, the stronger our connections, and the more, you know, the deeper those connections, the healthier our relationships, the healthier we are. That's what I've learned in the trees as well. They need each other. They need different species. We need different, you know, kinds of people. We need people of all cultures. We need people of all walks of life to come together and work together and support each other and create diverse communities, because, you know, forests have shown us that those diverse communities are more productive. They are healthier. We have tons of scientific evidence to show that. Sometimes we stray in our social structures to think that, you know, the dominant, you know, one is going to be the, you know, that it's going to trickle down and it'll save us all. Well, that's not really how it works. We're more self-organized. We're more grassroots. You know, thriftiness at all levels is important, not just at the top.
Suzanne Simard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Suzanne Simard, she's a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia. Her book is called Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.